So this topic which we have selected for discussion, which is the path of discipleship, is an important topic, especially in the context of today, where there is so much interest in one or the other kind of spiritual pursuits. Many, many seek a teacher, seek a guru. And there are many who claim to be teachers and who claim that they give the science of life, the philosophy of life. So there is so much interest in it that this topic is something that must be carefully examined and understood. Very important topic. So we must ask these questions like, what is spiritual progress? What is this spiritual path? How does one enter this path? Who is a disciple? And who is a teacher? So there are so many popular ideas about teacher, disciple and the spiritual path. We'll not go into examining them because that is not the intent of our talk. But we must be aware that there are many misconceptions prevalent in the world, and all of them more or less arise from a mistaken notion of man's true real nature. The real nature of man is misunderstood. The purpose of existence of man is not understood well, and therefore all kinds of misconceptions arise. So what we will do in the course of this talk is to examine these ideas and see what the ancient sages have to say upon this subject. So first let's consider, or let's begin with, this idea of spiritual path. What is spiritual path? Let's understand it from the perspective of what we are well acquainted with, which is the path of material progress. In order to understand what is spiritual progress, let's begin with the idea of material progress. So we are all aware of it. Instinctually, we all more or less follow it, which is concern with material things, interest in material object, material comforts, security of material things which one possesses, acquirement and enjoyment of material desires, or the pleasures which material objects bring us. So primarily, it seems to be focused around the idea of one's physical body, its comforts, its desires, its inclinations, its security, and its happiness. So body is seen as the source of one's happiness, and any impartial observer will find that taking this or pursuing this path will lead us to constant disappointment and constant pain. We are in search of constant pleasure and happiness, but on the other hand, by following this mode of living, this mode of thinking, we are brought to constant disappointments, constant pain and constant sorrow. And the teachers say that this thirst for existence in physical body, this thirst for enjoyment of physical objects related to earthly things, is the cause of our repeated rebirths. As Krishna says in chapter 3, all creatures act according to their natures. What then will restrain effect? So as we act, so will the effect be, and if our thought and action is revolving around material things, we will be again and again brought into material existence, again and again be bound in a physical body. Elsewhere, Krishna mentions this state as rebirths rapidly revolving. We involve in rebirths rapidly revolving, which are mansions of pain and sorrow. He calls it the mansions of pain and sorrow. What we seek and what we see as the source of our happiness, which is centered around the idea of oneself and one's body and its pleasures, Krishna calls it the pain, the mansions of pain and sorrow. This is something for us to think about. So if this is the path of material progress, the opposite of this is spiritual progress. Is the material path involved and related to matter, and there is a spiritual path which is involved and which is completely concerned with spirit. So in the former, in the path of material progress, we are attached to body, and in the latter, that is one who wishes to follow the path of spiritual progress, there's complete detachment from material things. There is a striving towards control of one's desires and not giving in to one's desires. This one who has entered this path, a very good example is to be found in the Upanishads, where Nachiketas is offered by Yama wonderful gifts. Even a 1,000th part of it, if it is offered to most of us, we would fall for it. But Nachiketas was one who had completely understood the delusions and the constant source of pain in material things. So he was able to perceive and not fall into the trap which Yama places before him. Let me read this, what all Yama offers Nachiketas, what all temptations that Nachiketas was subjected to, and how he discerned between what is real and unreal. So Yama speaks, choose sons and grandsons of 100 years and much cattle and elephants and gold and horses. This was said of that age. We may correspondingly see what are the material comforts of this age. He says further, choose the great abode of the earth and for thyself live as many autumns as thou wilt. If thou thinkest this an unequal wish, choose wealth and length of days. Be thou mighty in the world, O Nachiketas, I make thee an enjoyer of thy desires. Whatsoever desires are difficult in the mortal world, ask all desires according to thy will. These beauties with their chariots and lutes, not such as these are to be won by men, be waited on by them, my gifts. But what does Nachiketa say? He says, tomorrow these fleeting things will wear out the vigor of mortal's power. Even the whole of life is short, thine are chariots and dance and song. Not by wealth can a man be satisfied. Shall we choose wealth if we have seen thee? Shall we desire life while thou art master? But the wish I choose is truly that, coming near to the unfading immortals, a fading mortal here below, and understanding, thinking on the sweets of beauty and pleasure, who would rejoice in length of days? And so on, Nachiketas goes. So here is a clear example of the path of material progress and the opposite path of spiritual progress. Now, when we speak of this student who is traveling on this path of spiritual progress, when he say that he has complete detachment to material objects and things of the earth, we must remember that this renunciation that he has achieved is not the renunciation of external objects themselves, but an inner relinquishment, an inner separation from interest in these objects, interest in anything related to body and its circumstances. It does not mean running away to Himalayas. It does not mean giving up the life in which one is positioned and seeking some change of external condition by staying in an ashram or going to any monastery or any such change at all. It does not mean that at all. Krishna has made it very clear in the Bhagavad Gita that this is not the renunciation that he speaks of. The renunciation that the teachers speak of is being in the world but not of it. Which means he is situated amidst all the things which a normal man is situated in. He faces all the circumstances of life that a normal person would face. In fact, he would face more problems, a student who is traveling on the path of spiritual progress. But he is completely detached inwardly, which means he has no selfish interest in what he thinks, what he speaks and what he does. It is not outer renunciation and change of condition or going away into forest seeking peace, but being in the midst of the most tempting situation but not being tempted by it and inwardly being equal minded. This is the true renunciation which the student, the one who wishes to become a disciple, strives to accomplish. Of the others, those who externally renounce but inwardly are still attached to all these objects, externally they have given up. They may be wearing a yellow robe and call themselves sannyasis, but their minds, if it is attached to objects of sense, Krishna speaks of such people, such kind of people in the third chapter like this. He says, he who remains inert, restraining the senses and organs, yet pondering with his heart upon objects of sense, is called a false pietist of bewildered soul. But now the contrast he shows, one who truly renounces. But he who, having subdued all his passions, performeth with his active faculties all the duties of life, unconcerned as to their result, is to be esteemed. Do thou perform the proper actions. Action is superior to inaction. So here clearly Krishna distinguishes between false renunciation and true renunciation. So such a disciple, not only has he inwardly renounced everything, he goes further and sees that the whole of the material existence is not for enjoyment. On the contrary, it is for the purpose of experience and emancipation of the soul. Which means he does all the duties of life, as we found in the third chapter of the Gita. And the sole aim of performing all the duties of life is the highest good of humanity and not any selfish interest. So we find in the Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali, teacher mentions that this whole universe, visible and invisible, exists for the sake of bhoga and apavarga of the soul, which is experience and emancipation. So not only has he inwardly relinquished it, he sees everything as an opportunity to serve the grand and the great aim of experience and emancipation of the soul. So this is what we find Krishna explaining further in the same chapter. On the third chapter, in the middle of the third chapter, we'll not read that, but he mentions this very clearly. He says there that the wise man does not stop performing his duties at all. In fact, he does it perfectly so that he may inspire others to do their duties of life. So there is this student who is traveling on this path of spiritual progress. He has moved away internally from being attached to external objects, and he has found the source of happiness and life deep within himself, within his own consciousness, within the in listening to the voice of conscience within himself, the voice of divine conscience. So of such people, of Krishna says in chapter 9 that those who thinking of me as identical with all, which means a student begins to see the same self in anything that he does, anything, any being with whom he interacts with, in all relationships. He sees that there are no separateness of self. He has overcome the idea of separateness and he sees oneness, the one self he sees in all. So Krishna says, for those who, thinking of me as identical with all, constantly worship me, I bear the burden of the responsibility of their happiness. This is true happiness, not the other happiness of the path of material progress, which we discussed some time ago, which brings us to constant disappointment and pain. So the student begins to seek within for the source of happiness and true life and enlightenment. And this is what all true teachers point out to. They say that you must first find the divinity within yourself, and this is the first step. There is no way that any teacher can help you, can come in contact with you, any true teacher can come in contact with you, unless you have developed with your own strength and power and exercising of discrimination that inner flame of divine light. If that is not lit up within oneself, there is no help that can come from any teacher from outside. So there is no way that we can find the teacher outside, in the outside world, unless the true teacher of each one of us, which is our own divine self, which is there in all beings of whatever kind and whatever grade, unless that is found, there is no teacher that can be found outside. So this is a very important point, and all true teachers stress upon this. All true teachers bring this to our mind. We find this in Dhammapada, where Buddha says about self that the self is the lord of self. What higher Lord could there be? When a man subdues well his self, he will find a Lord very difficult to find. And even Krishna says that if you provide the right kind of conditions, then I will sit within your heart and dispel the darkness. I will sit within your heart and make sure that spiritual illumination shines on your mind. He says, I am the origin of all. All things proceed from me. Believing me to be thus, the wise, gifted with spiritual wisdom, worship me. Their very hearts and minds are in me. Enlightening one another and constantly speaking of me, they are full of enjoyment and satisfaction. To them, thus always devoted to me, who worship me with love, I give that mental devotion by which they come to me. For them do I, out of my compassion, standing within their hearts, destroy the darkness which springs from ignorance by the brilliant lamp of spiritual discernment. So this is the promise that Krishna makes to all who wants to travel the path of spiritual progress, that seek the true self which is in all and keep it in mind and put your whole attention on it, and that spiritual light will dispel the darkness of ignorance. So the other point that we must consider in this subject is that no teacher can come in contact with a student, a disciple, unless the student has furnished the appropriate conditions and has acquired qualifications, the adhikara, so to say, for the teacher to be able to help the student, for the teacher to be able to come in direct contact with the student. What the teachers can at best do is, they say that these are the teachings that are which speaks about the science of life, which speaks about the true progress, and he leaves it to the disciple, he leaves it to the student, and it is completely dependent on one's own self effort. Our progress further is completely dependent on our own self effort, and no teacher, even 1,000 Buddhas or Christs, cannot push or pull any person even a hair's breadth, even an inch further or backwards. So this idea of self-effort is primary to the path of discipleship. Just by offering oneself as a disciple to a teacher, if we think that the teacher will be able to raise us and liberate us and give us moksha, is completely mistaken. It comes from wrong understanding of one's own inner nature and the purpose of existence. So all teachers say that this is the way that one has to follow, and it's up to each one of us what we make of it. Did we not find in Buddha's Arya Marga, the Noble Eightfold Path, he begins it with the first step, which is Samyak Darshana. That is the right view of life, the right perspective. And this perspective comes from knowledge. And we find Shankaracharya also constantly stressing upon the first step being jnana, or taking of knowledge. So this must be borne in mind. This must be borne in mind. Now, a kindergarten kid cannot be admitted as a research associate for a professor. kindergarten kid cannot become a research associate for a postdoctoral professor because it's useless. It's not going to benefit anybody at all. The kid has to learn, it has to pass through the various stages, pass the various examinations, grow accordingly, and then become fit by having the proper qualifications to be taken as a research associate to a postdoctoral professor. So just an analogy to understand this. So this, in this path of discipleship, we found in the light on the path, there are four primary rules that are mentioned. Let us read what it says and let's try to understand it. It says, before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. Meaning that one must have reached, the student, the disciple, must have reached a state where he is unmoved and undisturbed and unswayed by personal emotions of liking and disliking, of all the emotional nature, of the emotional nature of the personality, personal liking and disliking, all this should not be able to sway his mind and should not be able to disturb him from his path of duty. Second, it says, before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. So he is reached a place of a state of equal mindedness where he is not sensitive to all the noise that the world makes. All the various temptations, the pleasures, the fears and the anxieties that are there, his ear, which means his inner ear, has become insensitive to all these things. Is this not what we found in Nachiketas, where he was offered so many things, but he remained true to the path of truth? That's the state. Thirdly, it says, before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must have lost the power to wound. Absolute non-violence. Now, we think that, especially in relation to spirituality and such topics, that eating certain kind of food or not eating certain kind of food is spirituality. Whereas, we find that that is not what matters. The general tendency is to begin at the wrong end, to take mistake effects as causes and causes as effects, to take non-essentials as essentials. Food, clothing, sleeping, eating, breathing, all these things are made much of, whereas the most important thing is your thoughts and feelings. That is where the path of discipleship, that is where the crux of understanding this path of discipleship lies. We think that eating meat is violence. Teachers say that if you are used to eating meat, then please go ahead and eat it. That is not what is violence. There is a greater harm that is done by our feelings of thought, feelings and thoughts of hatred, revenge, jealousy. That creates tremendous disturbance, and that is true violence. That is what transforms into speech and action also, which are but the subsequent consequential steps of having such thoughts in your mind, such feelings in your mind. So non-violence then would mean completely overcoming the idea of oneself being separate from another. It is only when there is that sense of separateness in us that it leads to liking and disliking, comparisons, likings and dislikings, and then leads to violence. So violence would be separateness, non-violence would be unity, unity in our mind, seeing oneness in all. As Krishna says, as a single sun illuminates the whole world, even so does one spirit illumine everybody. So that inner perception is what would be true non-violence. Not just physically restraining from harming another, whereas engendering all feelings of resentment and hatred, and that is not what is true non-violence at all. Not physically restraining alone, but inwardly, in our thoughts and minds. So it must have lost the power to wound, the voice must have lost the power to wound in this context. And look at this fourth one. Before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. Which means all personal considerations are torn apart and sacrificed. In the sense of not becoming cold and indifferent to other human beings at all. No, not in that sense. But overcoming one's prejudices, overcoming one's preferences for this or that based on personal desires and motives. So he's completely sacrificed that. That would be what we can understand from the fourth stage. So if we look at all these four primary rules, which as the text says, all students must attend to, all disciples must attend to, what we find is that it speaks of, all this can be summed up in one word, which is altruism. Altruism. Unselfishness. Let's see what Krishna says of one who has reached this state of altruism, this state of equal-mindedness and complete self-sacrifice to the good of all beings. He says, he also is my beloved servant, this is from 12th chapter, who is equal-minded to friend and foe, the same in honor and dishonor, in cold and heat, in pain and pleasure, and is unsolicitous about the event of things, to whom praise and blame are as one, who is of little speech, content with whatever cometh to pass, who hath no fixed habitation, whose heart, full of devotion, is firmly fixed. This is what he says. Just an example of illustration of one who has reached that state. So such a student, a very advanced stage, one who is able to accomplish this. He is moved away from what we may call as Dehatma Bhava, or the feeling of oneself being this body and being moved by the conditions and circumstances of the body. He is moved away from that into Sarvatma Bhava, or the feeling of identifying oneself with all creatures and not just with his. And he is completely renounced his body and its overcome the desires and controlled his mind and desires. So this is when the faculty of Viveka, as Shankara calls it, Shankaracharya calls it or defines it in the Viveka Chudamani, he says Nitya Nitya Vastu Viveka, which means that the ability to discern between what is real, nitya, or permanent, or eternal, and what is anitya, or impermanent, true, untrue, and false. So he is able to inwardly discern this, and just like the mythical bird, Hamsa, which had the ability such that if you give it a bowl of water mixed with milk, it is said that it had the ability to only separate the milk and drink only the milk when it is mixed with water. So symbolizing this keen buddhic faculty of discerning between real and unreal. And then he would have overcome ignorance to a large extent. And what do we mean by ignorance? Ignorance is not illiteracy. Ignorance is what is defined in the yoga aphorisms of Patanjali as the notion that the non-eternal, the impure, the evil, and that which is not soul are severally eternal, pure, good, and soul. So this confusion or inversion of a view wherein we see the non-eternal as eternal, the impure as pure, the evil as good, and what is not ourself as ourself, this is ignorance. And a disciple is one who has overcome this ignorance to a large extent by studying the supreme science of self, or the science of the supreme self. It is only when this qualification has been acquired by a person that the teacher is enabled to appear deep within the depths of his own heart, as it is said in the voice of the silence, the hall of wisdom. In the depths of our spiritual consciousness, then the teacher appears and not to be found outside. So this condition has to be furnished by each one of us if we are to meet the true teachers of humanity. Unless we achieve this unaided by any external, any teacher or anybody else, unless we do this unaided through our own self-effort, we will not even be visible to, the teachers will not be able to help us directly. The teachers will not be able to show us the higher signs of life, because we are not even prepared with the lower stages. The lower stages, we haven't even finished first standard, second standard, and high school and college. How can we expect us to be taken as a research associate for some grand research when we haven't even acquired the basic qualifications? So the rules of discipleship is clearly mentioned by the teachers. I'll read this seven set of rules which is mentioned, which all disciples are asked to strictly follow. Of course, this is a very high state, but this is something that we can keep in front of us as a model and shape our life accordingly. We will not be able to achieve this in many, many, many lives, but this is what we will have to strive towards. So the qualifications expected in a chela or a student, a disciple, is: one, perfect physical health; two, absolute mental and physical purity; three, unselfishness of purpose, universal charity, pity for all animate beings; four, truthfulness and unswerving faith in the law of karma, independent of any power in nature that could interfere, a law whose course is not to be obstructed by any agency, not to be caused to deviate by prayer or propitiatory exoteric ceremonies; five, a courage undaunted in every emergency, even by peril to life; six, an intuitional perception of one's being the vehicle of the manifested Avalokiteshvara, or divine Atman, spirit; seven, calm indifference for but a just appreciation of everything that constitutes the objective and transitory world in its relation with and to the invisible regions. These are the seven rules. And the teachers say that all students must have more or less developed this. The inner nature must be developed by oneself, unhelped by any other external things, before he could be actually put to test. It is then that we are ready to take the other greater responsibilities, only when these have been accomplished. So you see, it's not easy at all. So this self-evolving ascetic, see what the teacher uses, the self-evolving ascetic, one has to evolve himself through one's own self-effort. He has to master, one, his sharira, body, two, indriya, senses, three, dosha, faults, four, dukkha, pain, and is ready to become one with his manas, mind, buddhi, intellection, or spiritual intelligence, and Atman, which is highest soul or spirit. This is what has to be accomplished. And so we see here again great stress is laid upon one thing, which is self-exertion, self-effort. Because the very purpose of existence, if we understand it, is unfoldment of one's own latent, hidden spiritual perceptions. This cannot be done by proxy. This cannot be done by another person for oneself. Shankaracharya very nicely says this, that if you are ill, if you have fever, if your father takes the medicine, you will not be cured. You are the one who has to take the medicine. And if you are ill and you keep repeating the name of the medicine and not take the medicine itself, then also there is no cure. So complete stress is laid on this important factor. So Buddhas are but signposts. They cannot lift you, they cannot pull you, they cannot push you. The very immutable laws of nature is such that there is no pushing and pulling possible. No pushing and pulling possible. So if a student achieves all this and he is accepted as a teacher, as a student to an enlightened one, which itself is a very high state, being accepted itself is a very high state, and then his path of still higher progress begins, which would either end in complete enlightenment and merging oneself with the whole of manifested universe inwardly, identifying oneself with all, or it would end in failure, depending upon one's own self-effort again. At every point of time, at every stage, at every breath that you take, what you choose, what you do, do you choose this or do you choose that? The choices are there before us, and each one has to progress only through that making moral choices. And how to make the right kind of choice which leads us quickly to the grand end and aim of emancipation? Through the study of the teachers' doctrines, the teachings which the teachers have given, this we discussed about so many grand and sacred and spiritual things. To begin at our level, what is the best that we can do? The teachings have been given to us. We must study that. We must begin to cleanse our mind. We must begin to Start that inner purification, because discipleship is nothing if it is not a purely mental and a moral effort. Mental and a moral effort. All the rules that we saw of being a disciple, the crux of that is mental and moral effort, and not to do with you may a highly advanced student, an accepted chela of a teacher, maybe sitting next to you, maybe there in the market somewhere, you can never know. It's all inner spiritual progress. So what is needed is, at our stage, to begin this, as Buddha says, the journey of a million miles begins with a single step, and the first step is to take knowledge, to acquaint ourselves with this science of life, to remove the wrong ideas and take what the teachers have said as the basic laws of nature, study it, see what it says, and gradually transform your life. Because what is it that binds us? What binds us is, let me read this verse from Manu Dharma Shastra, where he says, it is your mind. It is your mind that either binds you or the mind that liberates you. If your mind is, as he says, vishayasaktam, which is asakti towards vishayas, vishaya, which is asakti towards external objects, then that is what he calls as bandham or bondage. So, mind alone is the cause for bondage and the liberation of men. Attachment to objects of sense through the mind makes for bondage, while withdrawal from them leads to liberation. So this, for us to, for our mind to move away from attachment to objects, it can be possible only when we find that, only when we are able to discern what is real and unreal. If our mind is based on, if our thoughts and feelings are based on wrong ideas, then we begin to mistake unreal as real, real as unreal, as the yoga aphorisms say. But when we study the teachings of the teachers, that purifies the mind, shows us what is actually real, what is unreal. Nice example used by Shankaracharya, that you don't mistake a snake, a rope to a snake, or a snake as a rope, but you see things as they are. You begin to see things as they are. So this begins by acquirement of knowledge. And this is the lesson that we are all learning. We are all disciples in that sense, because we are all disciples. We are all in this stages, different stages of learning, wherein the teacher is one's own divinity within oneself. We are learning all this, as I said in the Sankhya Karika, that different kinds of pain torment us, and the immediate response is usually to seek for some external remedy for it. When pain comes, when sorrow comes, when disappointment comes, when some wrong thing happens, the immediate response is to usually seek for external remedies. But he says in Sankhya Karika, it says, you try that, but there is an absence of certainty of solving the problem in anything external, and permanence of pain. So gradually these experiences lead us. We are all going through this. It leads us to the understanding that spiritual knowledge has to be taken, and the knowledge of spirit. We are all too well acquainted with matter, but our real nature is one of spirit, and that has to be acquired.